Hello and welcome to the Meclis, a Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I am Mohamed Tahir, director of the Turkmen service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. It's been already some time since Russian economy is in decline, and equally the Central Asian financial markets are dwindling together with recessing Russian economy. In one of the Meclis podcasts last year, we discussed that millions of Central Asian migrant workers in Russia, Moscow being the biggest trade partner of the region, the effect will be unavoidable. Now, today in the Meclis, we will revisit the region to see how much that effect has been so far. To discuss the subject, I have Alex Nice, who's feeling the pulse of Central Asian economy in his role as a Central Asia editor at the Economic Intelligence Unit. Peter Leonard, the Eurasia Net Central Asia correspondent, who is on the ground witnessing realities. Also joining me, Bruce Panier, the editor of Kishlak Owazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yes.
Good to see you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Yes, the Russian economy remains in bad shape and it will worsen further. The situation is not only affecting the country, but the crisis is looming large with every new day in Central Asia. The recent data from Central Bank of Russia puts a staggering number of 50%+ fall of remittances to Tajikistan from Russia, and half of the Tajik economy, as you know, relies on remittances. Let's first look at how the effect has been so far on the ground. Peter, can we start with you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just to flesh out those figures a little bit, I mean, the actual numbers as far as Tajikistan are concerned are the most dramatic, probably, and the drop in remittances from 2014 to 2015 was of around 67%. So that's a drop, in other words, from about 3.8 billion to, if I'm not mistaken, 1.3 billion. And so, you know, that's the country that's feeling the pain the most. And because it has the economy which is most reliant on remittances, roughly 50% of GDP, then that's feeling the impact the worst. But the figures are no more reassuring for Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, although in terms of the proportion to their economy, the effect is slightly mitigated, although not by a great deal.
Since you touched, Peter, Uzbekistan in the wider region, Alex, Uzbekistan is another country hugely rely on remittances from Russia. What do we know about the effect of Russian crisis to this country on the ground?
Well, I mean, it's hard to judge much from the local statistics in terms of the impact of the economy. So it is more, in terms of getting a picture, it relies on the kind of the journalistic reports we get from people in the country, and then I guess the limited data we have about the external position, and obviously fall in remittances to Uzbekistan is going to be a large part of the picture, and a big part of why I think we have to be very skeptical about the official growth figures from last year for Uzbekistan. Likewise, if you look at the level of imports, say, to China from Uzbekistan and from Russia, then they've fallen significantly in dollar terms over the past year, partly, I guess, because of lower gas prices and lower cotton prices as well. Yeah. But it also just simply suggests a weaker external demand, which is also putting a lot of pressure on the economy.
Right. Bruce, is the fall of remittances is the only consequences of the Russian effect to the region?
Well, I mean, of course, the local currencies have taken a hit, too. So even their own buying power, people who aren't migrant laborers are feeling it, too. Even if you had a job in any of these countries, you would still notice that you were able to buy less. You have less buying power when you go to the store to get basic goods. So, yes, I mean, there's been an effect pretty much across the board on the economies of these countries. And of course, the people, the poorer you are, probably the more you feel it at this point.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point that you raised, Bruce. Numbers aside, what has been the pain on the ground, especially when you look into some figures from Tajikistan? It says like 80% of people under 29 years age is unemployed in Tajikistan today. Peter?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at, for example, it's very hard to speak in very general terms about this, but I mean, again, returning to Tajikistan, when you see the most recent quarterly report by the World Food Program, they talk about you know, the real risk of food security being becoming, you know, a more kind of parlous situation than usual. The thing is, food security is always an issue in Tajikistan. Uh-huh. There's a, you know, roughly 20% of the rural population, which is a, basically in a permanent state of grievous food security, and that is going to be compounded only more by the whole remittance situation. I would say on top of that, though, I mean, to address slightly the question that you put to Bruce, I mean, obviously, you know, when you talk about falling remittances, you know, one aspect of it is to obviously, you know, the family budget is that much smaller. But the other thing, and there are all these kind of knock-on effects, which I think Alex will be able to talk a bit more fluently about, into the economy. And again, in Tajikistan, what you're seeing is you know, all kind of different aspects of the economy are being very badly hit. And in particular, the finance sector, which in real terms translates to, for instance, you know, one of the largest banks in the country is kind of on the verge of pretty much of collapse. So it's something of a miracle that it hasn't formally collapsed already. And, you know, a lot of people are, have gone several months without getting their salaries simply because the bank just doesn't have the cash to pay them. And so, you know, it's on one hand, what we see is a trend of the same old problems getting worse and worse. And then there are new trends, which you're also kind of seeing emerging in the past year or so.
What are those new trends, Peter?
Well, exactly as I say. I mean, when a bank, when state workers are, you know, not getting their salaries for up to 3 or 4 months, then, you know, that suggests that there's something, you know, clearly wrong with the system.
Right. Other than food security, in terms of effect, in some countries, price for utility bills are increased, like Ashgabat cutting off its famous free utility to some products. What kind of effects have been visible looking throughout the region, Bruce, like on Uzbekistan, for example, in Kyrgyzstan in that case?
Well, no, Uzbekistan, for example, just raised its utility rates at the start of April. As of April 1st, they went up. You know, and of course, they got the same problems that Peter just described here now, where you have amazingly huge amount of people who are either haven't been paid for a while, or in some cases more than 6 months, and it's absurd the kind of people that haven't been paid. It's one thing, you know, when you're talking about the factory workers and, you know, civil servants and stuff, but I mean, we're talking about security agencies, you know, banks, of course. There's been all kinds of cases. I said even the security forces are not getting paid, and their wage arrears go back as much as 6 months in some cases. So obviously there's a huge crisis going on there. And we remember that last year even the Uzbek Central Bank said they might not actually have enough paper money to pay people at the moment. So, you know, and that's in Uzbekistan. You know, Tajikistan, of course, we're going to have the same problem. And Kyrgyzstan, you know, the difference between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan compared to like Uzbekistan is that wage arrears are not so uncommon. Kyrgyzstan's gotten a little bit better, but this has been, you know, pretty much a chronic issue for them since independence. So the patience level might be a little higher in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan for this. It'll be interesting to see how long Uzbekistan can stay quiet if they continue to be unable to pay. You know, and like I said, it's one thing if it's just simple workers in factories or something, but when it's government officials, you know, essentially, then you got a problem.
Alex, you are an economic guy. We touched upon the states not being able to pay salaries of their employees. What does it explain in terms of the states of the economy in a larger picture of those countries?
Just to touch briefly on the utility cost issue, which I think is a very interesting one. And obviously, in the case of Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, that's a clear indicator of distress. You know, these subsidies and utilities, sort of essentially free services that have been available for many years, which are either being cut back or prices are rising. But at the same time, I think in other parts of Central Asia, we could see the opposite problem, which is that, for example, in Kazakhstan, faced with high inflation, with food prices going up a lot and imported good prices going up a lot, then utility prices are going to be kept down by the authorities, which in the short term, obviously, is very good for the population, keeps inflation in check. But what we then see is that these utilities run into arrears. And in the case of Kyrgyzstan, of course, the gas, there have been numerous problems with debt of the gas provider. And in a context where, for example, Kazakhstan is trying to privatize assets, but at the same time is putting pressure on utilities to to hold down prices, then that's going to also create difficult problems and also restrict investment. So you're going to have a situation in the medium term where infrastructure improvements are not made, and the kind of chronic problem of poor infrastructure carries on. So it's a sort of double-edged sword in some ways, case.
If I could just jump in too, I remember that of course the utility rate increases played some role in the Kyrgyz revolution in 2010, and I'm sure, and Peter would probably know more about this than me, but I know Barki Tajik, which is in charge of the electricity in Tajikistan, has been running up a debt for years and years, and it's been one of the government's greatest fears that what happened in Kyrgyzstan in 2010 could easily be repeated in Tajikistan. So the government is paying huge subsidies, but Tajik utility company Barki Tajik is hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to the Iranians and Russians who own the hydropower plants, Sangguta 1 and 2.
Peter, what does people say about this situation and these days on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, just before I get to that, I mean, I'm pleased Bruce brought up the issue of the electricity provider in Tajikistan, Barki Tajik, and their failure to pay on or to be paid rather by their biggest debtors, who are of course the aluminium Tajik aluminium company, and I think this actually addresses a very serious aspect of the problem that we're discussing today, which is that when we talk about rising prices for utilities, we tend to assume this as a bad thing, and of course for most people it is, although international consultants, whenever they're asked, will tend to say in a place like Tajikistan or even Kyrgyzstan for that matter, it's an inevitability that prices for utilities do need to be allowed to float upwards and come into line with market prices. But the problem you have, say, in Tajikistan is that, there is no real market because half of the money that's owed to the national electricity company is owned by a company which, according to some people, is essentially, a big kind of piggy bank for the president's family. And so in that situation, you can't realistically talk about allowing utility prices to be put up for the regular population when the president gets not to pay for his own electricity bills. But that point aside, as to what people say, I mean, I have to say, I mean, if one expects to find, a lot of anger, say, or, sort of tempers flaring, my experience is quite different. I mean, I would draw the example of the favorite friend of journalists, the taxi driver, one who I had a conversation with in Bishkek the other day, who said, the thing about us Kyrgyz is, we're masters at surviving, and, we've survived the 90s, and the same way we survived the 90s, we'll survive this. I personally find that argument always a little bit disingenuous because, of course, people have grown to, have adapted to a much higher standard of living and have different expectations. But there is a kind of a grain of truth in that, people have been through this kind of thing before, and I think there's a lot more capacity for withstanding, extreme sort of moments of crisis than, we tend to be used to in the West. At least this certainly goes for the poorer countries of Central Asia. In Kazakhstan, it's a slightly different situation because what you have there is really a population which is growing used to the kind of the comforts of middle class living, whether it's buying a fancy new car or a house or a new kitchen or what have you. And now all of that is kind of going out of the window. And in fact, I would say when you come to speak of Kazakhstan, the country which one invariably finds oneself comparing it to closest is Russia. And I found a very interesting article this week talking about how, something in the area of 80% of Russian households have burnt through their kind of rainy day funds. And I don't know what the figures are for Kazakhstan, but I would be surprised if they're anything lower than that. And so, I think that the really kind of crunch time is probably going to be coming now when all of those rainy day funds have gone. People have got used to, the fact that they can't really splurge on the luxuries and comforts, and what happens after that, I don't know.
Peter, it's interesting that you touched the last two countries that you touched, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. Alex, these two countries, it seems to me, that came out not in a good shape, but also not as badly hit as the other Central Asian countries. Why is that?
Well, in the case of Kazakhstan, I mean, simply it's a much wealthier country, and unlike Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, you know, they have large external assets, sovereign wealth fund, which they've used to try to have some kind of counter-cyclical stimulus program to boost demand. So there has been a capacity also. I mean, you know, there isn't the same issue about wage arrears, although even after the devaluation of the tenge, we've seen some oil companies, there seem to be some conflicts between workers and managers in some areas and commodity sector. So, you know, quite simply, you know, they have more resources to try and counter some of the worst impacts of the economic slowdown, which obviously in the case of Tajikistan is not there. And whilst Kazakhstan also suffers from high levels of corruption and clearly a very concentrated ownership structure, then it's still not on the same scale as Tajikistan. And this is an economy that is more dynamic. So I think that's one reason why the impact has not been so serious. On the other hand, I completely agree with Peter that in some ways the political impact perhaps are more interesting in Kazakhstan, because you do have this expectation of rising living standards, which the government has sort of bought into for many years, and in some senses legitimized itself at the back of this kind of developmental approach. And a middle class and high employment in service sectors, which are fairly highly developed and are now really going to suffer in the coming years. And so it's precisely the kind of urban middle class part of the population that in some ways is going to find the largest impact as a result of the devaluation and the slowdown in the economy, whereas those working in the manufacturing sector, state employees will be less affected. And obviously then the large chunk of the population, which is still based in sort of rural or semi-rural settings. I think there's an interesting sort of twist there in some ways. There are higher expectations from what the government would deliver, and therefore potentially possibility for greater disappointment and anger.
Mm-hmm. Other than food security and unemployment, high unemployment, there has been another interesting development in some of those countries, especially in Tajikistan, which is devaluation of the national currency and further restrictions on exchange and trade of foreign currencies. Where does this move or step falls in terms of the declining economy or the signs of financial crisis in that country? Who wants to take this question?
I would simply say, we're kind of repeating ourselves a little bit, but I think that Kazakhstan has definitely felt it, the devaluation, of, I think, far more intensely, simply as Alex has said, because the expectation of being able to buy foreign goods buy into that whole kind of consumer.
Peter, I wanted to, you know, draw the attention towards, especially that's true with two countries there, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, where buying foreign currency today become almost impossible. So how this is connected to the fall of the economy in that region or in that country especially?
I mean, I think it's very hard to talk about how it feeds into or is caused by the fall of the economy, because it's actually very, in my experience, very difficult to kind of get a feeling of the pulse of the population as to how they're kind of suffering, how they're feeling the impact directly. But I think what is very interesting is that the measures which both the countries that you've mentioned, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, have taken have been completely security based. You know, in any other kind of country, you might expect a kind of an economic response or some sort of a kind of a stimulus plan or something to kind of get the economy going. But as far as the issue of getting hard cash into the country is concerned, both of those countries have essentially either criminalized or banned, you know, be it changing money or transferring money in various different ways. And so this really shows the kind of the very limited menu of solutions that these two countries in particular have when it comes to dealing with economic crises. And that, again, doesn't really augur very well for the future, because it suggests that you know, the governments of these countries really only have sticks, and you know, they haven't even got around to thinking about what carrots they might be able to offer people.
The interest, Alex, you want to say something? I just wanted to draw the another kind of contradictory point here. We understand the extension of the Tajikistan's economic crisis today, which is connected to remittances that comes from Russia, or the high volume of Tajik and Russian economic ties and everything. And they have taken these restrictions in terms of their foreign currency exchange in the country. In the same time, on the other hand, you have Turkmenistan, which does not have that much of economic ties with Russia, but is taking even more harsher measures to keep control on foreign currencies in the country.
Right.
So what does this contradiction explains here?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the driver of the downturn and the crisis that the government finds itself in is to do with a fall in energy exports, lower oil prices. I mean, we don't have a lot of information about the gas price, what gas prices sold to China, although, as I was saying, that the external data we have now, we have 2015 trade data for China, does suggest that the value of those exports has fallen, either because volumes are lower than they had been projected, or else because the gas price does fall as the oil price falls, which seems plausible. And this obviously has then had a knock-on effect on the state of government's finances, and it seems that they're responding by trying to cut back on expenditure on state wages, and also there are subsidies which is impacting on household incomes. And in addition, clearly there's a lot of uncertainty, as you say, then around the exchange rate. They seem to be reluctant to allow the currency to devalue a second time, which would help to relieve some of the pressures on the external sector. And instead, they're introducing various controls, which might formally maintain this peg for state or privileged companies which are able to access foreign currency at the official rate, but the effect is obviously to create a large amount of economic disruption and make it very difficult for ordinary households to access dollars, which effectively means that you know, if you're operating at a black market rate, which is a lot weaker compared to the dollar, then your income is basically has to be calculated in dollars at that black market rate if you're not able to get the official rate. And so what we've seen, I mean, this is all fairly speculative, looking from the outside on the basis of the limited amount of information we have, but it seems that the kind of combination of these restrictions, a fall in export revenue, and a cut in government spending has really hit the economy and growth. But again, it's hard to get a very complete picture or indeed generalize very, very firmly.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, Alex. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will discuss what the Central Asian governments are doing to heal the problem and how productive or unproductive those steps have been so far. Let's take a short break. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Today we are discussing effect of continued Russian financial crisis on Central Asia and measures the regional authorities are taking to curb the effect on their prospective countries. Discussing the subject with me is Alex Nice, who is the Central Asia editor at Economic Intelligence Unit. He is participating from London. Peter Leonard, Central Asia correspondent for EurasiaNet. Peter is joining us from Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlag Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is joining me here in the studio. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Is there, Peter, you are on the ground, is there any official acknowledgement of the effect of Russian situation to Central Asian countries by local authorities? What do they say about it?
As far as Kyrgyzstan is concerned, the line is quite simply that obviously the economy has been affected, but, you know, we made the right decision in joining the Eurasian Union, because this is always the background music. The one, I think, anxiety that the government in Kyrgyzstan has is that people might try to associate the economic difficulties in Kyrgyzstan with their membership in the Eurasian Union as of last year. And so that's essentially the mantra. You know, as you know, Central Asian governments don't tend to give particularly, you know, elaborate explanations for whenever things are going wrong. So it would be a mistake to expect them to do that. As for everywhere else, you know, Tajikistan is an interesting case. You know, you read speeches by the president, and according to him, everything's going great, and the economy is, you know, in tip-top shape and whatnot. So, you know, this is, again, culturally part of the problem, is that governments in this region are not really prepared often to confront the scale of problems until, you know, they're completely overwhelmed by them.
Talking about Uzbekistan, Bruce, what this country is doing in terms of to remedy the crisis they are facing from fall of the remittances and the declining Russian economy, what are they doing?
Well, Uzbekistan for several years now has instituted these programs where, or on paper anywhere, they're creating all these jobs so that in theory they won't have to have 2 million official migrant laborers, and a lot of people suspect it's more like 4 million or even more than that. You know, in practice, they have tried to create some jobs, but it's been, they only have so much to deal with, and their idea of creating jobs is to divide up what they already have and parcel it out amongst everyone. So we had this situation in just 6-7 years ago where, again, in about 2009, when the economy was getting bad in Russia and some people started to return, the Uzbek government had this program where they were going to have a million new jobs created. What that boiled down to was forcing farmers to accept labor hands from these returning migrant laborers, and then split up the farmers' income was then had to be divided out amongst all these newcomers that they were forced to take. I suspect that we're going to see a similar situation pretty much across the board. I know our Tajik service talked to people in the labor ministry there at the start of this year, and he also said, yes, we've created, you know, tens of thousands of new jobs. And then pressed on that point, he admitted that only 30% of those jobs could be considered to be full-time labor. So this is going to be tough. Peter mentioned a while ago about, you know, the potential of stimulus programs, and I think that that's one of the things that these countries, it's not even so much that they're lacking, but I don't think they even have the capability for the most part of doing that. That would be the natural resort in such a situation, but they're so tied to the Russian economy and to Chinese money too that they themselves don't have enough money or the creativity to come up with these new programs that could give employment to the population, to the people that would come home, or to the people who are now out of work within the country. You know, and you end up with a case where, you know, with President Rahmon in Tajikistan repeating once again just a while ago that time to stock up, you know, 2 years' worth of food in your house. You know, I mean, you know, that's the solution.
Alex, one thing is that, you know, some of those leaders are, you know, putting out slogans that they are creating jobs and everything. In fact, which is not the case, but even if they like to do something for people who are coming back to the country or the declining local economy and everything, are they in a position to do anything, as Bruce just touched upon? Do they have enough resources to do that?
Well, I think this is a real problem, that resources and capacity is limited, and institutions to handle it are weak as well. I mean, fairly obvious that Tajikistan in the next couple of years is going to need significant external support. Now, whether that comes from the IMF or Russia or China, I think, you know, it's going to have to come from somewhere. I think the IMF is going to face a really difficult decision. I mean, in terms of how they handle negotiations with the government, partly for the reasons Peter was talking about, that, you know, the playbook that they would like to impose doesn't really work in a situation where a large part of the economy is in the hands of the president or his family. And, you know, so providing a large amount of funds, which, you know, these countries and these governments really need, is going to be difficult, because tracking where that money goes and whether it actually is used to support the economy, to create jobs, stabilize the finances even, is very difficult. And of course, that may be one reason why, although the IMF and Tajikistan, the Tajik government appear to have had negotiations. You know, in the end, it might be Russia or indeed China that provides more funding, given that the conditionality is often less problematic for the government's concern. So, yeah, and I think we have to be very pessimistic about the prospects for the state or the government really providing any solutions for ordinary people in Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan or indeed Uzbekistan to this economic downturn, and in the sense that there is that kind of that sense of self-reliance which is there, which has been developed over many years, because you know the state in general does not deliver a lot for people. And again, this comes back to thing we were talking about earlier, that perhaps then the expectations in Kazakhstan are slightly different.
If I may just make a point, I mean, I honestly, the thing that always makes me a little bit nervous is that the only anti-crisis program that countries in the region appear to have, whether they are energy rich like Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, or remittance reliant like the other three countries, is just, you know, sweat it out, wait till we come out the other end, and then, you know, the good times will come again. And I think that the real danger of that strategy is, whether it's, you know, energy prices, you know, may never be, you know, back to those kind of sky high levels that we've been used to in the past decade. And as far as remittances are concerned as well, I mean, I think it's very interesting, for instance, that, say, in recent days, this rhetoric of the criminal migrant has rather returned to the scene in Russia. I found this rather fascinating, that even President Putin and the head of the FSB, Patrushev, was speaking in great detail about what they've described as a very worrying rise in the migrant crime. And clearly, the message there appears to be that, you know, this situation needs to be addressed, and you know, I'm sure they would like to repatriate a lot of labor in Russia in the long term. And so the expectation that countries that are reliant on remittances have, that, you know, well, once Russia kind of gets over this hump, then things will go back to the way that they were before, I think is a very dangerous one indeed.
Yeah. Alex, you touched the open possibility of outside actors playing role in helping those countries to deal with the current situation. It seems that even outside actors are having difficult time on how to navigate the help that they want to provide to some of the Central Asian countries. Peter, actually, the quote I'm referring to here is coming from your organization, Your AsiaNet. This is the quote from Cheng Ching-Yu, that is ADB, Asian Development Bank Country Director for Tajikistan. He published a blog post on March 18 in which he describes his institution as frustration with Tajikistan that they provided $60 million in 2015 to Tajikistan to help, but the outcome was disappointing. So what is the option going forward to Tajikistan to deal with this situation as one of the poorest countries in the region? Peter?
The only thing I will say is when you look at the whole range of international financial institutions, you find, you know, there are some forgiving ones and some less forgiving ones. And I would say, in my very sort of ignorant perspective, ADB tends to be, you know, very generous and give a lot of latitude to local governments, and tends to trust maybe more than other ones do. And when they start telling you that they're frustrated and that they really don't know what they're going to do because, you know, all this money they're investing in these countries just seems to be wasted, you know that's a problem.
Alex, you want to say something?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And I think in Tajikistan, for example, there doesn't seem to be any acknowledgement of, it was saying, firstly, the severity of the situation, or indeed the need to come up with a new, well, any kind of real meaningful economic strategy. And there is a real challenge for these countries that Russia is very unlikely to return to the levels of growth we saw up to 2008, or indeed even, say, 2010 to 14. You know, those sort of levels of remittances we saw may simply never come back again. Now, you know, remittance channels may change. I'm sure, obviously, at some point, you know, Russia will return to some sort of low level of growth, but I think the trend is likely to be weak, and the demand for external, you know, migrant labor may be significantly lower than this is now. Will it be possible to develop other channels to export labor and to bring in remittances? If not, what is going to be the source of growth for these countries? It's hard to see. So I mean, I think it's, you know, the situation over the past 15 years has not been one of particularly marked development, improvement in living standards. But I think the outlook for, you know, even beyond this immediate crisis is what we should really worry about years of stagnation and the impact that will have on the populations and also actually on perhaps on political stability in the medium term.
All right. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up our discussion here. Finally, Bruce, so what options do you see for Central Asian leaders going forward to come out from this situation as best as they can?
You know, they're going to have to expand their foreign relations. I'd like to think that they're going to rein in corruption and cultivate more efficient internal systems, but that would be hoping for a lot. But, you know, I mean, we've already seen in the case of Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, in some case, that they're drifting toward the Middle East and seeing if they can find new financiers, since China and Russia are for the time being kind of on the sidelines. You know, Peter made a good point that the Western institutions are loath to lend to these people unless they're willing to make certain amounts of changes, which they've been unwilling to make. I would mention, though, for what it's worth, and I know this is a lighthearted comment that's probably out of place here, but these bad economic times have been great for new national holidays. You know, we got one tomorrow in Kyrgyzstan, and they're about to have a President's Day that they're going to name a new holiday in Tajikistan. I mean, I alluded to that as a great distraction in earlier works this year, but, you know, and Kazakhstan's had one, and I suppose maybe now that's one of the indicators of how bad your economy is how many new national holidays the government's pushed through so that people can feel a little bit better about what's happening in the country.
I mean, I guess a lot of people have a lot of free time at the moment, so what else are you going
to
do?
Yeah, if there were unpaid holidays, it would actually make sense. It might help to...
Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Also, big thanks goes to Alex Nice, the Central Asia editor at the Economic Intelligence Unit, Peter Lennart, Central Asia correspondent for Eurasia. And thank you, gentlemen, for being part of the Majlis today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.